So our session here this afternoon, and first of all, I'm Heather Pryor, not Jay Holman, moderating. We made a switch, so there we go. This is the life sciences track on the future of biology and health. Our first speaker, Chloe Liu, is going to be speaking about informed cancer diagnoses. So please, Chloe.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming, and I also want to thank the organizer for this chance to present my work. My name is Chloe Liu, and I'm a PhD candidate from the Goodman Cancer Institute at McGill University. I am from the Department of Biochemistry and the lab of Maxime Bouchard and Luc McCaffrey. Today, I'm going to talk to you about promoting human flourishing through accurately informed cancer diagnosis. So to start off, I want to tell you how I define human flourishing for the purpose of this talk. And I have summarize it into three aspects. The first about promoting human flourishing is to live fully as the image of God we are created to be. From Colossians chapter 2, verse 9, "For in Christ all the fullness of the deity lives in bodily form, and you have been given fullness in Christ, who is the head over every power and authority." And so I think that means to live a purposeful life. In the context of cancer diagnosis, I want to take a moment now to invite us all to reframe our understanding of cancer diagnosis. Instead of seeing it as a battle to fight, I want to invite us all to think about it as a race to run. It is an important race within the longer race of life. And so the quantity of life, which is equivalent to the length of the race that we can run, and the quality of life, the well-being of the patients during the run, are both very important. The next aspect to human flourishing is to experience the love of God. From John chapter 3, verse 16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life." And so God has established a covenant with his people, and it is a covenantal relationship that is based on promises and fidelity. In the context of cancer diagnosis, there are two relationships that I want to mention here. The first relationship is the caregiver and the patient relationship, so the patient and their family members or friends. The other relationship is the one between the patient and the supporter, so the doctor, the researcher, etc. And these two relationships can be understood through a biblical covenant ethic as fidelity between the person and the vulnerable patient, grounded in the agape love of God for humankind. The third aspect to human flourishing I want to talk about today is to live in Christ. From 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, this means that anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. The old life is gone, a new life has begun. And so in the this to me means to live in a human flourishing is to live in constant communication with God. The journey of cancer diagnosis can be challenging, and it is challenging. And so receiving guidance and reassurance through Christ can make a big difference. Part of promoting human flourishing can be established through promoting or developing accurately informed cancer diagnosis. And I'm going to focus on prostate cancer, since that is what my PhD research is on. Prostate cancer is the most frequent non-skin cancer in men. And as we can see here from the bar graphs, the five-year survival rates drop significantly as the cancer stage advanced. And so early diagnosis of aggressive cancers can save a lot of lives. On the other hand, we also know that many prostate cancers are not aggressive. And so patients can live on without ever being affected by any symptoms or illness. And we see that from the autopsy studies where there are men who died with prostate cancer without ever knowing or being affected by it. And so the concept of overdiagnosis, which is inaccurately diagnosing a slow-growing cancer as aggressive, can decrease patients' quality of life. It gives emotional burdens to the patients, physical burdens from the potential side effects, which side effects to treatments which do not offer any therapeutic benefits because the patient would have been fine anyhow with or without treatment. So it's better to not add any more burdens. It also adds more burden to the healthcare system in general as well. So altogether, we need early and accurate prostate cancer diagnosis. To do that, we study the precursor of prostate cancer. It is known as PIN, prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia. PIN is not cancer, but it has been shown to be the stage before cancer starts. So that is what my lab is interested to study about. Unfortunately, we do not know much about the precursor of PIN, the precursor of prostate cancer. What we do know about it is how to recognize them when we see them. So in a normal setting, when a patient has abnormal screening results, they will be referred to get a biopsy, and the pathologist will look at the cells to see whether there's cancer or not. And they look at it from H&E stainings, which are images shown here. If you follow my cursor, you can see that this is an individual cell. So as the other one, and then the next one. And then the darker spots here are the nuclei, the cells made up of the prostate duct. So you can see that it is organized in a sort of like a circle. And then there is this white space in the middle that is the lumen. This space is filled with fluids from or secretions that the cells will give out. And so this is a prostate duct, and then this is another prostate duct. Outside of these prostate ducts, what we see are the stromal regions that are filled with stromal cells. So when we look at the control, which is the normal regions of a human prostate, we see that the cells are nicely organized and connecting with one another. However, when we look at PIN, the precursor of prostate cancer, we see that the cells start to overlap and stacked on top of one another that we can't really see them clearly anymore. So this is the way that pathologists, this is a simple explanation of the way pathologists identified PIN. And so since we know the existence of PIN, a lot of clinical trials had been carried out to see whether patients with PIN have a poorer prognosis than patients without PIN. From equally valid trials, we have different results. Some groups said that patients with PIN do have a poorer prognosis, that they are more likely to have aggressive cancer. But other groups said that patients with PIN have a similar progression with patients without PIN. So this is where our group comes in. Our hypothesis is that although PIN looks similar, we hypothesize that they are different on the protein level and that there are different types of PINs. There are PINs that will lead to aggressive cancers, and there will be PINs that do not lead to. So for my research, we're trying to separate those two to improve our diagnosis. As biochemist, I'm also a cell biologist, so we want to understand the biology of the cells in the precursor of prostate cancer. To do that, we collaborate with a local hospital called the McGill University Health Center to get patient samples. So we have 36 patients in our cohort, and they received surgical treatments as part of their cancer treatment. And so we get their patient their samples to study. With the help of the pathologist, we are able to, for each patient, we identify a control region and a precursor region. Then we look at the cells and study them. Normally, we use microscopes to look at cells. However, with my research, we want to look at many different protein markers, which traditional microscopes do not allow us to do. So we use a newer technology called the imaging mass cytometry to look at the cells and take images of them. So if you recall from earlier in the presentation that the human prostate is made up of prostate ducts in sort of circles like this. However, I would like to point out here that most of the cases, the prostate duct is not perfectly circular. However, they are always continuum, at least in a normal case. In cancer, this continuum will be broken, but we're focusing on the precursor for this presentation, and so the prostate ducts are still intact. So inside here is the lumen, and this is another lumen. And outside of the ducts are the stromal regions that are filled with stromal cells. The prostate is made up of three major types of cells. The first is the basal cells, which are in red, and they made up the outer layer of the duct. And then there are the luminal cells that are in green, and they made up the inner layer of the duct. There are also neuroendocrine cells, the ones in orange. They are a rare cell type, but they interspersed within the prostate duct. There are also immune cells in the prostate, and these immune cells are part of the immunity, our immune system. And they are not just there when we have a cold or we have a fever. There is a healthy amount of immune cells in the normal human prostate as well. So for example, we have helper T cells, cytotoxic T cells, macrophages, and B cells. There are also endothelial cells, and these are the cells that made up the blood vessel in the prostate. So we want to understand more about how the precursor of prostate cancer is different from the normal prostate. So we apply different protein markers on the surgical specimens and get images like this on the left. So here in the middle is a drawing of the cells, but on the images, the colored dots represent proteins. So, and from depending on what protein it expresses, we can know what cell type it is. So for example, in red here is the protein CK5, and basal cells basal cells express CK5. So we know that these red cells here are basal cells. Similarly for green here, green is the protein CK8, and we know that luminal cells have this protein, so these here are the luminal cells. And here in the middle is the lumen, and outside in magenta are the stromal cells. In the bottom image here, we can also see the many different immune cell types that are getting close to the prostate duct. And in this case, it is in gray. So looking at these images, we want to understand what is different. So just to reorient ourselves a bit, the cyan in here, in this case, is the basal cell, the outer layer, and then the magenta are the luminal cells, that is the inner layer. And then here in the middle is the lumen, same as this place. So I want to draw your attention to macrophages, which are in red here. Macrophages are part of our immune system, and they are responsible for recognizing something when there's something abnormal, and it can stimulate immune responses. Here, when we look at the control, we see that the macrophages are closely linked to the basal cell layer. So this is the macrophage, this is another one, there's another one here. But when we look at the pin, the precursor, we see that there are the macrophages are associated more with the luminal cells, and it is more in the middle of the duct. So seeing this pattern or change in pattern, we hypothesize or we start to ask questions. What are the macrophages doing there? Keep in mind, this is not cancer yet, but it seems like the immune system is already recognizing something there. What is it? I want to draw your attention now to the helper T cells, which are in green. Helper T cells are another type of immune cells, and it works with macrophages to trigger the immune system to get rid of things that shouldn't be there. And so similarly in control, we see that the helper T cells are located more in the outer layer of the duct with the basal cells. But in the pin, they are more in the lumen and associating more with the luminal ducts. In this case, we can even see the helper T cells interacting with the macrophages. So this is suggesting to us that something is happening. And depending on what it is, it can help us to identify the subcategories of PIN and to know whether a PIN is aggressive or not. Besides the cell types, we also wanted to look at 17 other protein markers for which we hypothesize may play a role in cancer progression based on what we know in the field so far. And there are a few markers. There are four protein markers that came up to be different in PIN. Then they are AMARC, and these proteins are AMARC, phosphohistone H3, CD166, and phospho-S6. These are all more expressed in PIN. And so in the images here, in white are the nuclei, and then in red are the markers, the protein markers that the column represents. And the top row is the control region of the patient, and then the bottom row is the precursor regions of the patients. And here we see that there are more red cells in PIN, so suggesting there are more proteins of these kinds in PIN. I won't go into detail on what these proteins do, but essentially they are all involved in either the metabolism or the interaction of the prostate cells. And we know that prostate cells do not exist in isolation. They are interacting and constantly being influenced by each other. So we want to ask the question, how are these markers or cells with these markers interact with one another? So what we want to find out now is whether these cells, and then we try to group all the cells, we group all the cells together, all the cells in the control, in the PIN, and the patients, and put them into groups based on what marker each of the cell tend to be next to. And we're able to classify them into six regions. Here, the density of the dark red bars represents the marker that the region is prominent in. So for example, in region number one, the cells are more likely, more or less randomized in terms of the markers that are present there. But in region two, it is rich in AMARC positive cells. In region three, there's a lot of CD166 cells there. And in region six, there are a lot of beta catenin, CD166, and phospho-S6. There are also a couple phosphohistone H3 cells there too. So now we want to look at what that means in the control and the PIN context. So here in the middle are the images of, in white are the nuclei. So they tell us where the cells are and where the prostate ducts are. And on the right, we see that there are certain colored regions that are present in PIN, but not in control. With all these precursor features that we identified, we then want to identify the ones that will lead to aggressive cancer. Just a reminder, our hypothesis, again, is that there are different types of PINs. So there will be ones that are not aggressive, so they are non-problematic, and there are the ones that are aggressive, which we do want to address. So our collaborator put, with the patient's consent, our collaborator put our cohort into two groups. The first patient group is for patients who got abnormal testing screening, and so they got a biopsy, but they were negative for prostate cancer. And 2 years later, they got a follow-up biopsy, and they are still negative for prostate cancer. For the second group of patients, they also had abnormal screening test, so they got a biopsy, and they were negative for prostate cancer. But 2 years later, they are positive for prostate cancer. And just for context, prostate cancer is generally a slow-growing disease. So when we see that cancer appears within 2 years, we are defining it as aggressive. And so with these patients and their biopsies, we want to ask these questions. Which precursor features are only in the biopsies of patients from group two? So these will be the features that are only present in the aggressive cancer, or at least the precursor of the prostate of aggressive cancer. The second question is, are these features already present when cancer was still negative? If they were, we can be able to identify this type of cancer that we need to address before cancer happens. And so as part of taking care of God's creation as biochemists, it's important for us to have a more accurate perspective on the nature of cancer so that we can improve clinical care. This is important so that we can be faithful stewards as well as be faithful stewards wisely with what God has given us, the wisdom, the gifts, the tools that we have. Although biochemists who work in the lab might not be interacting with patients on a day-to-day basis, we are still in relation with patients. And so it can be modeled by, it can be seen as we can have a covenant with patients. And this covenant can be modeled by the covenant with God. So when I think about how God established a covenant with me as his people and how that affects my attitude in doing research, I see there are three major things I wanted to highlight here. First is, as a researcher, it's our responsibility from God to deliver science with the gifts that God has given us. And this is a way for us to love our neighbors. The second one is that we're doing research and the motivation comes not from fame, money, or any other things, but it's a motivation from God. We are doing kingdom work through promoting human flourishing. We can also experience providence from God. God gives us strength, hope, wisdom, grace as we continue to be faithful stewards for him. God also gave me a community that I'm very blessed to have. Throughout my research and my training, I have seen God in each of these interactions. I would like to thank Dr. Maxime Bouchard, who was my PhD supervisor, and he actually passed away last year from cancer. And Maxime was an irreplaceable mentor. He had taught me a lot about how to do scientific research since he accepted me in the lab 5 years ago as an undergraduate student. He taught me the importance of being curious, observant, and philosophical when it comes to doing science. I also want to thank Dr. Luke McCaffrey. He was best buddies with Maxime, and although his research area is a bit different from ours, he kindly stepped in and take us, me and my lab members, into his care, and he's my current supervisor. God also gave me an amazing fellowship of lab members. We journeyed together through the late stage. We journeyed together as students as we went through this journey of diagnosis of our main supervisor. We are all cancer researchers, and we knew exactly what his diagnosis meant and the uncertainty that would have been ahead of us. I'm really thankful that God put them into my life, and so we can bond together. Although we are not all Christians in the lab, we're able to communicate, share our burdens, our thoughts, our challenges, and I also have the chance to share my Christian faith and perspective with them as well. God has been good, and he is faithful. I also want to thank Dr. Simon Chevalier. She is our collaborator. She makes our research possible with the patients that we're able to collaborate with. She also cares and gives me guidance, especially with her expertise in prostate cancer, especially after Maxime passed away. Global Scholars Canada, through my time as a student intern at this organization, I am encouraged to connect my faith with my study, and that is also where I first heard about the ASA or CSCA. And in the varsity, fellowship at my school, these are the people who prayed for me in my lab. We rejoiced, we mourned, we support and encourage each other. Dr. James Rustelven is a mentor that I met through Global Scholars Canada. He helped me to solidify my ideas and put this presentation together. He also encouraged me to actually apply to present in this conference, even though I didn't think I was able to do it. And he also shared his experience and wisdom with me. So I'm encouraged that it's possible to integrate science and faith. Here are some of the references about my work or my talk today, and I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Chloe, for your courage and for the beautiful way that you've told this story that incorporates your faith, and it's very meaningful.
Yeah. Your mass cytometry images are absolutely gorgeous. Some of those are some of the nicest I've ever seen with this technology, so congratulations. So do you think that ultimately you're going to go more in a single-cell RNA-seq in biopsies where you can see what the bigger pattern is?
Yes, Thank you for the question. So I'll just go back to here. So what I presented today is part of my PhD project, and actually what I'm currently working on is to do spatial transcriptomics experiments. So that means we're trying to understand the genetic expressions of these two biopsy groups to get to know more about what is going on in this precursor from a genetic level or molecular level. So yes.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
Was the PSA test used in conjunction with this study? And also the second question I have is more on the diagnosis side. Maybe you can't answer it, but I have a friend that's going through breast cancer and they use cryotherapy. I'm assuming they're using that also for prostate cancer. I don't know if you can comment on the effectiveness of that.
Right. Thank you for your question. So in terms of PSA, that is the protein, prostate-specific antigen, that has been the traditional way of detecting prostate cancer. If you have more of these proteins, there's a likelihood that you have prostate cancer. So that is indeed incorporated into my research, as that is how we selected our patients. So when I mentioned about, like, they did, not all patients get a biopsy. They get a biopsy when there is an abnormal test. And so that is one of the results that came.
Thank you, Corey. Yeah, your work is beautiful and very organization. I learned how to integrate our research with our face, the neck. I have the question about your macrophage. Can you go to maybe six, maybe eight or what? Yeah, here. Did you see you say macrophage is like a CD, it's redder, right? It's
yes.
Redder, right?
CD68.
Yes, and the helper T is green, right?
Yes.
Did you see your macrophage, that the red one? Did you see there are some yellow spot there? Yeah.
Right.
Did
That's
you think this one you think is a combination of the macrophage and the helper T?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question and a very good observation as well. So mm-hmm. If you see closely, there are some speckles of green / yellow.
Yes.
So it can either be a helper T cell interacting with macrophages,
yes.
Or it can also mean that there is the protein CD4 inside the macrophages. So this is actually something that my lab members has found, that there are CD4 positive macrophages.
Actually, this is show double labeling. Right, this is a show, this is yellow one, right? Mm-hmm. This is a combined staining there. Yeah.
This side will have to look more carefully with immunofluorescence, which is another technique that gives us higher resolution. But if it was actually like the same, it would have been more yellow than just a few speckles.
Because so, I have the experience, I tell you, because okay. Usually red mm-hmm. and with the green, they mean double labeling. This means this tissue may be double express some protein, mm-hmm. something there. I just
yes.
remind
yes.
you. Yeah,
thank
okay.
You.
Pay attention to this spot.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Hi, Chloe. Excellent Hi. Presentation today. Really well done. And sorry that I was crying at the end of it. I'm a big sob. Oh. Anyways, I'm going to ask you a science question because that's the only thing I can get through right now. Mm-hmm. Your CD4 labeling is beautiful. And I think your question about the double labeling is really interesting. But on your final slide, you teased us a little bit because I saw CD8s on that slide. So I'm just wondering if you've seen anything interesting with those cytotoxic T lymphocytes, because we know that they can interact with epithelial layers and secretory tissues in really interesting ways.
Yes.
Any preliminary results about that?
Yeah. So currently we are also, like, since we are looking at we're looking a lot about where the cell is, mm-hmm. and we look at in the epithelium and the stroma region, how are there more cytotoxic T cells or any other immune cells in the prostate duct or outside of it, and we're currently doing the analysis, so maybe I'll keep you updated after we get it, but that is something definitely in the scope of my research. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Chloe, again.